the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting live today from Nashville, Tennessee. And wherever you are, I hope you're ready to talk about having a debate. Well, not so much on this program, but in the larger culture. The question is this: who's afraid of an argument? A very fascinating article published in the journal Sociology this week, the journal Society. It is a sociological journal of a large and growing academic respect. It, of all places, is not where you would expect to find exactly what this week's edition has. And that is an article by a fellow at the Center at the University of Virginia on the fact that it is the pro-abortionists right now who have no arguments. It's the pro-life side that has the arguments. The pro-abortionists won't even engage in a debate, in an argument, because they run out of points. And they're on the defensive. Now, this is very, very interesting. When a sociological journal starts to take note of this pattern, you know that something's up. That's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to be looking at this article. And John A. Shields of the Center on Religion and Democracy at the University of Virginia has produced a truly interesting piece. And we're going to talk about why we should have hope that the pro-life argument is really starting to take hold. The main reason is there's not much of an argument on the other side, just a lot of assertions. We'll get to that in just a moment. First, a review of some issues in the news, and there are many of them, of course. The Harvard president appears to be in trouble all over again. President Lawrence H. Summers is in trouble, being attacked by his faculty. Once again, looks like there may be a second no-confidence vote held. A no-confidence vote in a Harvard president is unprecedented. A second one is unthinkable. And the thought is that the Harvard Corporation, that is the Board of Trustees of the university, may act to suggest that President Summers should step down. Or, in other words, find some way to ease him out. That would be a disaster, folks. Let me just tell you, this is one of those cases in which a board of trustees just has to stand with the president, because the president's doing the right thing. Everything the president's being charged with doing here is what presidents are hired to do. And that is what makes it so interesting. In the postmodern academy, you hire a man to lead, and he starts to lead, and he gets in trouble. You hire a man to actually reform the institution, and he starts to do so, and he gets in trouble. The big issue in higher education is whether the faculty has unilateral control of the institution. That's what's going on at Harvard. And Lawrence Summers, who is, after all, a former United States Secretary of Treasury, a man of power and influence, and a man who knows how things work, he went into Harvard and decided to make some changes, and those changes are not what folks there have wanted, and they're kicking back. And I know how faculties kick back. It's just this pattern. They will hold a vote of no confidence. They'll say, look, he's hard to work with. Well, what would easy to work with look like? Evidently giving the Harvard faculty everything they want. Folks, are you listening to all the talk about global warming and all the rest? I don't know where you are, but the northeast section of the country got hammered just in recent days. We've had different parts of the country reporting weirdo and bizarre weather patterns this time of year. In much of the central states where we live, it's been warmer than usual. Is it global warming? Well, how does global warming produce warmer weather here and colder weather there? Well, some meteorologists or climatologists may actually have an explanation for that. But it's a theory, folks. You wouldn't know that reading the Washington Post, which in a story published over the weekend said this: Greenland's glaciers are melting into the sea twice as fast as previously believed, the result of a warming trend that renders obsolete predictions of how quickly Earth's oceans will rise over the next century, scientists said yesterday. Let's just look at that sentence for a moment. So scientists, until this report published on February 17, 2006, said that the glaciers are receding at this rate. Now we know that it is worse than twice that. So much for the scientific validity of the report that came before. It was only off by 50%, at least. The next paragraph. The new data come from satellite imagery and give fresh urgency to worries about the role of human activity in global warming. The Greenland data are mirrored by findings from Bolivia to the Himalayas, scientists said, noting that rising sea levels threaten widespread flooding and severe storm damage in low-lying areas worldwide. The scientists said they do not yet understand the precise mechanism causing glaciers to flow and melt more rapidly, but they said changes in Greenland were unambiguous and accelerating. Folks, I'm in no position to argue with this data. I am not a climatologist. What I know about glaciers is very, very little. But what I know about all the controversy over global warming and the human impact on the environment is important for us to talk about, what you know about it and what we don't know about it. Because the fact is, no one knows to what extent human beings are or even could influence these vast climatological patterns. Now, you may know that in recent days, evangelicals have released different statements, opposing statements on the issue of global warming. The one suggesting that we ought to be very careful about even buying into the concept was actually organized some time back, but just in recent days, a group of evangelicals, including many prominent evangelical leaders, have signed a statement suggesting that there needs to be urgent attention to global warming, and with that, an agenda that would reduce the human impact on the environment, etc. Now, we as Christians need to be very, very careful about these environmental issues, because, number one, we know whose world it is. It's not just an evolutionary fact, a naturalistic, materialistic reality. This is the world God made. And he has given us a stewardship responsibility and a dominion responsibility, and we will give an answer for how we keep this. Just imagine that if a landlord gave you his garden and said, tend it, and it better be better when I come back. That's exactly how God has given us this earth. We are to exercise our dominion over it. We're to dam up rivers. We're to build houses. We're to till the ground. We are to produce crops. We're to do all kinds of things. But to God's glory, it should be better because we've been here, not worse. Now, if we find out that we're doing something to make it worse, we would want to know that, wouldn't we? We would want to know that, and we would want to know if there's a way to fix that. We really would. But before we jump to conclusions, let's just remember that this so-called science is so preliminary, and the factors are so complex, and the length of time for such measurements are so vast that we just don't know. So I say that in order that you would be very reluctant to buy into either of these agendas, either those who say it absolutely isn't happening, there isn't such thing as global warming, or if it is, it's just a natural phenomenon recurring over increasing cycles of time, and those on the other side who say global warming, stop driving your cars, let's cook with open fires. You know, don't buy into either of these extremes. Let's find out what's going on, but let's really be careful about saying what we supposedly absolutely know about these things. Youth culture update. Gay adolescents on campuses. The decade kids are disclosing their homosexuality with unprecedented regularity is coming younger and younger. According to a Penn State study of 350 gay young people, the median age at which lesbians have their first sexual contact is 16. For gay boys, it's 14. So in other words, the first homosexual activity is taking place at younger ages than were ever before imaginable. 16 for girls, 14 for boys. And when you're talking this kind of number, that means, of course, there are some who are younger as well as some who are older. Now, what makes that all the more remarkable is that that represents a drop of about 3 to 4 years over the last 20 years. So that means that what first took place at 18 or 19 is now taking place at 14 or 15. Just think of the impact on young lives represented by that one single statistic. Frankly, it's mind-boggling. And parents, if you're not alert and awake to this, you need to know that any parent that would allow their son or daughter to be involved in this kind of experimentation is going to find a very confused adolescent, and sometimes confused in the world's worst way. By the way, as you go younger and younger in the population, you find increasing support for same-sex marriage. These youngsters have been buying into the cultural message. That's all they've heard. They've been swimming around in the aquarium of popular culture ever since they were born. They've been hearing these messages of this false idea of tolerance. They've been told that marriage isn't all that important, and now they're believing it. UCLA is reporting that incoming freshmen on that campus support same-sex marriage by a 57% margin. In other words, 57% favor, and that leaves only 43% either unsure or opposed. Now, you can almost flip those statistics if you go just 30 years older. But, folks, who's going to be voting 30 years from now? That's the big question. And that just shows you where we stand in terms of this cultural conflict and in terms of our responsibility to articulate these issues, first of all, to our own children. Do you know about the Islamic doctrine of sacred space? That's what's going on in the background to many of these news stories about the intersection of the West and Islam. Some of you are aware that the distinction made in historic Muslim thought, Islamic thought, is between the world of Islam and the world of war. But now Patrick Sadikeo reports in The Spectator of London that Muslims see the establishment of Muslim communities in the West as a contemporary hajira, or that is, a sacred effort. And the goal is to establish these communities in order to take over the entire society. And that is the Muslim method of influencing a culture. You establish what are at first little islands of influence, but you press for the ultimate establishment of an Islamic state. You see, that's something most people don't know. The logic of Islam is the necessity of establishing a unitary state under the Quran. Now, you may wonder if some Muslims actually believe that, and I may join you in that when it comes to the fact that maybe some liberal Muslims, as there are liberals in other faiths as well. But the reality is that classic Islam is unambiguous about the necessity of filling the cultural space with Islam under the rule of the Quran. We need to remember that. We'll be right back to talk about who's afraid of the abortion debate. I'm Albert Muller. You know, when you're in the print media, you have to print corrections. Here we only have to talk about them. But sometimes they are doozies. In fact, one of my favorite things to look at in the New York Times is the correction section. But Newsweek has one this week that's really very interesting. Let me just read it to you. It's in the correction section, Newsweek magazine. In the February 6 article, Cut, Thrust, and Christ, we misquoted Jerry Falwell as using the words assault ministry. In fact, Falwell was referring to a salt ministry. A reference to Matthew 5:13, where Jesus says, "Ye are the salt of the earth." Folks, that's not a small problem. They were describing his ministry as an assault ministry. And don't you know, folks had a lot of fun with that. But it wasn't an assault ministry, but a salt ministry. Makes a big difference. So who's afraid of a debate on the abortion issue? You see, there are those right now who are going on college campuses, and they're around the country in the media and elsewhere trying to engage people in a debate about abortion, trying to talk about the real philosophical issues, trying to talk about what's really at stake. And the other side's not talking. So what's the stereotype? The stereotype will be it's the conservatives who don't want to talk, and it's the liberals who do. The liberals who are showing up with argument. That's not true. The pro-abortionists are not showing up for this debate. They don't want to be a part of this debate. They're running out of arguments. That is made graphically clear in an article that was published by the magazine Society. It's actually an academic journal, very well respected, published by Rutgers University in New Jersey. The author of the article is John A. Shields of the Center on Religion and Democracy at the University of Virginia. Don't waste time talking to anti-choice people. That's the advice given by NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and its campus kit for pro-choice organizers. The director of the Pro-Choice Action Network answered a question about why his group does not engage in conversation with pro-life advocates with this statement, quote, "Along with most other pro-choice groups, we do not engage in debates with the anti-choice." In other words, they're scared to death of an actual argument. And why? You know, you're not afraid of a debate. You're not afraid of an argument if you've got points to make, if you've got the truth on your side, if you have solid, reasonable, understandable points to make. Mr. Shields writes this way. He says, "If the conventional wisdom is correct, the religious right is once again corrupting American democracy by pushing religious dogma over and against science and reason." Nevertheless, Mr. Shields goes on to prove that the conventional wisdom is anything but wise. And I quote, "The critics have got it almost entirely backwards. Ironically, it is actually the secular left that has undermined a national discussion on vital bioethical questions, such as when a human organism deserves state protection, by depicting them as fundamentally religious and therefore beyond legitimate public debate." Very interesting point here. What they're saying is, and Mr. Shields in particular is saying, is that the pro-choice movement now simply says that all opposition to abortion is based in religion. In a very clever and insightful way, he shows how this works. He goes to John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign, where Mr. Kerry said, "I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I can't bring that into the public square because it's only a matter of faith." He talks about how the pro-choice, the pro-abortion movement has almost labeled this, has almost branded it as their mantra, that abortion should be a decision between whom? Between a woman, her doctor, and her God. You see, the only reason one can be opposed to abortion, according to the pro-choice logic, is based in some religious understanding. John Shields shows that that argument is absolutely empty. He throws it out of the water. He shows that it absolutely will not hold. This is what he says. He says that proponents of abortion rights and embryonic stem cell research correctly recognize that if the moral status of embryos and fetuses is solely a religious question, it is properly quarantined to the private realm of faith. In other words, just to interrupt him here, He says if they can just get America to buy the fact that the only arguments about the moral status of the fetus or the embryo are religious, then they can't function in public policy. He went on and said, it cannot be a matter of public political debate. Any effort to restrict abortion or stem cell research, therefore, is an unjustified assertion of sectarian metaphysics. But he goes on to show this just won't hold water. It just isn't true. It isn't true that you have to believe that even God created human life in order to believe that a fetus deserves protection. Now, why as Christians is this important for us to note? It's important for us to note because we as a movement, the pro-life movement, and Christians in general, conservative Christians concerned for life, are learning how to make these arguments more carefully, more accurately, and more in a way that will engage the culture around us. For instance, the group Justice for All goes around to college and university campuses, and it puts up a giant display showing the different stages of fetal gestation. And it simply asks people, at what point does this become human? At some point, it's a microscopic dot. At another point, it's a baby outside the womb. All right, if abortion should be legal at any point during that, but not up to when the baby's born, or only up to the very point when the baby's born, what's the difference between the fetus and the baby? People say, well, you know, size, independence, functionality. Well, as this group shows, and as the philosophical argument follows, the difference between a fetus and an infant is not a whole lot greater than the difference between an infant and an adolescent. You know, at what point does one become human? You see, that's a vital philosophical question. That's a debate worth having. That's the kind of debate that gets right down to the worldview issues and engages the issue where it deserves to be engaged. Do we establish public policy on the assumption that the human embryo is not human life? As John Shields says, well, that means that we simply risk becoming mass murderers if we really can't even have a debate about the moral status of the embryo. What about the moral status of the fetus, the unborn baby? Should we as a society rest comfortably with a policy that is potentially allowing the murder, the killing, the disposal, the destruction of 40 million unborn babies? I find this very interesting. I find especially interesting the fact that the pro-abortion movement is simply unwilling to address these questions. I want to know what you think about this. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Why do you think they're afraid of the argument? And I speak to you, and you know how I much feel about this issue. You know how much I am concerned about the sanctity of human life, how much I see the culture of death as the great enemy in terms of the battle for life here, how much I believe that we as Christians have got to keep our very best thinking capacity ready to defend the sanctity of human life. I think that is a gospel imperative. I think that is a Christian imperative. Do you find it almost impossible to engage people on the other side in debate? I find John Shields' article to be very revealing, very informative, and it was for me a catalyst to all of a sudden look back at this debate and say, you know, he's really onto something. We show up with arguments, and they won't show up. On college campuses, when pro-life programs try to even bring someone in to debate the issue from the other side, they won't come. You heard what NARAL Pro-Choice America said in their campus kit. Don't waste your time arguing with the anti-choice. Don't you love that kind of almost Goebbels-esque propaganda, the anti-choice? You heard what the director of the Pro-Choice Action Network said. He said, along with most other pro-choice groups, we do not engage in debates with the anti-choice. In other words, we're shaking in our pro-abortion boots. We can't look at that display that Justice for All puts up with those different stages of gestation and say, all right, we know that life begins there. We know that life deserves to be protected here. John Shields goes so far as to say that the other side only has a coherent argument when, like Peter Singer, it says, it doesn't matter whether the baby's born or unborn, it only matters whether it has certain functionalities. In other words, even infanticide should be allowable. Folks, now's the time to engage this debate. Just call me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Why are the abortion rights people so afraid of a debate? And what are we learning about how to shape this question and confront this culture with the truth? The phone number, 877-893-8255, coast to coast, today from Nashville, Tennessee. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the program. It is happening on college and university campuses all over the country. It's happening in the different civic spaces we inhabit, your local community, civic clubs, and all the rest. It's becoming more and more difficult to have a debate about the big issues. Now, people sometimes don't want to have a debate. And I'm not talking about the fact that there aren't people talking about this and yelling at each other. You can turn on certain shows where you know that's going to happen. I'm talking about a real sustained debate over the big issues. I mean, where people are actually talking about the big concepts, trying to lay it out, get to the bottom line, and figure out where we really differ, and then make the argument for your position. Show up with arguments. You know, the Apostle Paul at Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17 reasoned with the people concerning the claims of Christ. That's what we need to do. We need to reason with people. Sometimes Christians just show up with assertions and not with arguments, and we should be embarrassed when that happens. When you have a talking head on television that simply says, this is it, this is it, well, why? Well, I don't know, it just is. Well, that is fundamentally unhelpful. But the big problem right now is on the other side. It's the fact that the pro-abortionists aren't showing up for the debate. John Shields makes another point, and that is this. Look, they have Roe v. Wade. They have the laws right now on their side. Why should they debate? They're in a defensive posture. But as anyone who's ever been in a big cultural conflict before knows, you can't stay in a defensive posture for long. Because pretty soon people find out you're out of arguments. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I want to know what you think about this. Let's go to Robert calling from Shiloh, Illinois, listening on XM 170. Robert, your turn.
How you doing, Al? I think the major problem with the abortionists wanting to not argue is to keep the public on their side, as well as a lot of liberal causes. They need to keep the public uneducated about their points.
Yes, you know, ignorance isn't bliss, is it, Robert? And that they do not want an education on this. For instance, they certainly did not want an education on the fact that a procedure like partial birth abortion was being done. And what I find, just to make your point, Robert, what I find absolutely incredible is when, for instance, someone describes the partial birth abortion procedure, and then people say, you shouldn't talk about that, that's just scaring people. Well, it's actually killing people. And I'm sorry if it's scary to hear about it, but if it were not so awful, it wouldn't be scary. If it were not so horrible and tragic and unthinkable and evil, it wouldn't be revulsive. But ignorance is not bliss. We need to know. Thanks so much for your call, Robert. It's great to hear from Shiloh, Illinois. Let's go to Mark calling from Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on WTSJ. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, Dr. Mohler. I just wanted to say that it's just as Jesus said in John 3:20, where he says that everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. And that's pretty much the reason why they refuse to argue, because once they argue, they'll see that it's like shining a light on their argument, and their deeds are going to be exposed for the true evil that it really is.
Mark, what a great way to bring in a specific biblical text that speaks directly to this. That's right. You know, we have nothing to fear from the light, not if we have nothing to hide. And right now, what the pro-abortion movement is hiding is the fact that it has run out of arguments. Mark, I want you to hang with me here for a minute if you can. On the campuses of American colleges and universities, and I don't know how old you are, if you might be in college and university studies now, but on these campuses, the ministries like Justice for All are showing up, showing these different stages of fetal gestation and asking the question, when does life begin? You know, I think a part of getting this conversation started is asking the right questions. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what the truth is. When you ask the right questions, it causes people to question what is truth. It says, Paul, you know, Pilate asked Jesus, you know, what is truth? And Jesus knows what the truth is. And once you when you're in a relationship with Christ, you know what the truth is. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life.
Yes, and yeah, Mark, as you're saying, didn't mean to cut you off there. We also know that we didn't come up with this, that this is a wisdom far beyond ourselves, and it's a wisdom to which we are accountable. You know, here's another interesting question for human beings. On the day of judgment, what will we be found guilty of not knowing? Isn't that interesting? What do we not know that it is immoral for us not to know? Well, read Romans 1. There are things that have been revealed to all humanity that humanity just refuses to see. And I think the dignity and sanctity of human life is one of those. People will say, I didn't know, and the Creator is going to say, oh, yes, you did. Planted in the heart of every single human being. Written across the entire structure of creation. You did know. You just didn't want to know. The phone number, 877-893-8255. We've had some good callers. Join the conversation. 877-893-TALK. Why are the pro-abortionists not showing up for the debate? What have they got to hide? How should we continue to shape this debate in the way that will reach Americans? The level of the head and the heart. 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Bowler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler program. The issue of abortion brings out the best and the worst arguments, doesn't it? I mean, it's one of those volatile issues. America's been in this debate now for over 3 decades. That's a long time. Sometimes more heat than light. But to the credit of pro-life organizers and the pro-life movement in general, it's been moving into deeper and deeper and more responsible moral arguments, philosophical arguments, even scientific arguments, because the truth's on our side. We were on defensive at first because it was the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973 that threw the nation on its heels. Unexpected, out of the blue. Abortion was illegal one day, legal the next. How do we discuss this even among evangelicals? I posted an article at albertmohler.com today, and by the way, I posted one about the very study we're talking about here, an article entitled, Who's Afraid of an Argument? The Insecurities of the Abortion Right Movement. That's my commentary for today at Albert Mohler, M-O-H-L-E-R.com. But I also posted another article entitled, Anne Lamott and Her Evangelical Audience. And I raise this because writer Anne Lamott is known for being plain-spoken, and that's an understatement, by the way, and controversial. But she has a readership among many evangelicals. They will be shocked, I think, to read her op-ed piece published recently in the Los Angeles Times on abortion. Anne Lamott was participating in a panel discussion on abortion with a couple of, quote, progressive ministers and a Roman Catholic moderator. And one of these men had spoken of the abortion issue as, and I quote, morally ambiguous. This was too much for Lamott, who recalled how she responded to the moderator's invitation to speak a word. This is what she said. But then I announced that I needed to speak out on behalf of the many women present in the crowd, including myself, who had had abortions, and the women whose daughters might need one in the not-too-distant future, people who must know that teenage girls will have abortions, whether in clinics or dirty backrooms, women whose lives have been righted and redeemed by Roe v. Wade. My answer was met with some applause, but mostly a shocked silence. She went on giving the most over-the-top advocacy on behalf of abortion. She says this, as a Christian and as a feminist, the most important message I can carry and fight for is the sacredness of each human life, and reproductive rights for all women is a crucial part of that. It is a moral necessity that we not be forced to bring children into the world for whom we cannot be responsible and adoring and present. We must not inflict life on children who will be resented. We must not inflict unwanted children on society. Folks, some of what she said I can't read on the air because of the language that she uses, but I just have to wonder, and I have to tell you, Anne Lamott is an extremely gifted writer. She sees things in life that others don't see. She has an incredible gift for words. She's obviously very bright and very creative, and if she were just a writer coming from that perspective of the left, you know, I think I'd look at that and say that's predictable. But when she's coming from these positions and also has a big evangelical audience, when she speaks of herself as being, quote, Jesus-y, I don't know what she's talking about. She makes some good points about social ethics. She makes some good points about the necessity and imperative of justice in the world. But I have to tell you that I think her worldview is revealed when it comes to abortion in a way that gets right down to the bottom of my concern about her evangelical readership. I'm not saying evangelicals shouldn't read her books. You read books written by non-Christians. Read books written by people of all different stripes. But it's different to read books on the one hand and to consider someone kind of an exemplar of the faith on the other. Making that jump for Anne Lamott is, I think, very difficult. And I'll tell you the truth, I was just more or less heartbroken when I read her article because I think this shows a disdain for human life and a claim for personal autonomy that really is in conflict with the gospel itself. Let's go to Matthew calling from Salem, Oregon, listening on KCCS. Matthew, your turn.
Yes, Dr. Mueller, appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I think the pro-choice folks are afraid of the argument because of the questions we're asking. We're exposing the worldview to others, and we're having to get into, to their disappointment, a question about God. And as you pointed out with your Romans 1:20 text there that you quoted, I do have to ask a question, though, Dr. Mueller.
Yeah.
Mueller, and the question is, one way we're asking the right questions is on university campuses. There's the campuses were showing large pictures of aborted fetuses. And I have to ask to you, is that an appropriate way for Christians to be engaging the culture and asking the question on abortion?
Well, I don't know exactly what you might be asking, Matthew, and if I don't answer your question, just stay on the line and you can say so. You know, I think there are different ways to engage different parts of the culture. I would say, you know, for instance, driving that display down the street in a 4th of July parade would be inappropriate because that's not a teachable moment. I think even putting up that display in, say, the Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport Terminal would probably not be a good way for Christians to engage the discussion. I would argue that on some college and university campuses, it can be a very effective way so long as the people are winsome and kind and are just asking the question, you know, making clear we're not just doing this for shock value. We're asking the question, where here does human life begin? I do think it's a judgment call, but I have to say I'm thankful these people are doing this in the way. And by the way, John Shields' article is very, very interesting here. He is at the University of Virginia, and he talks about how this this debate is shaped up on different campuses, including his own. He seems to think that it actually has reached some people who otherwise would never, ever see those images and would never be troubled by them. One of the interesting things is that almost everyone who sees those images sees them as revulsive. The question is why. You have further thoughts on that, Matthew?
Well, I just have to point back to Romans 1:20, period.
Yeah. Okay, but apply that for me so I know what you mean.
Well, they understand that that there is a God. They see in every little tissue the his signature. And it's graphic. And because it's graphic, it doesn't leave you very quick either.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to develop in myself some discernment as to when that type of approach is appropriate or not appropriate. So you've been helpful for me in that area.
Well, I think we're struggling with that together, Matthew. I think we as Christians need to talk about this with each other because, you know, there are some who would say you do need to put it right in the middle of the airport terminal. You do need to put it on the float going on the 4th of July parade. I would argue for the right of people to do that, by the way, in terms of free expression. But I would have to say I don't think that's the most strategic way to reach hearts and minds. I think reaching 18 to 25-year-olds on a college campus requires a different approach than reaching, you know, the older women in the bridge club. I think, you know, just in terms of sensitivity there, that's very important. I think you raised the issue. And I especially appreciate the way you went back to Romans 1:20 and said what you meant. That's what I assumed you meant, but I wanted to hear it in your own voice. The problem is, again, we're denying what we know. We really do know these things. I think every single human being knows that human life is distinctively sacred. And I think Paul helps us to understand why. He talks about suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. In other words, the more we give ourselves to certain sins, the more we hide the truth from ourselves. That's the power of the corrupted human conscience, which, by the way, Paul talks about very, very clearly in Romans 2. And that's why Jiminy Cricket's advice really doesn't turn out to be too sound. You can't just let your conscience be your guide because your conscience is also affected by sin. We'll be right back. We've got another caller on the line and some final thoughts. This is the Albert Mueller Program. When you're looking at arguments made in the public square, realize that there may be more or less there than first appears. You really have to work hard to trace these arguments back, track them back, take them apart, and that requires Christian thinking. That requires the use of the intellect. That requires a structured use of reason, and, well, it requires us to grow up as Christians and get ready to enter this debate with knowledge, with reason, with worldview, and with the full measure of Christian conviction. We got Mark on the line calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin, listening on XM 170. Mark, your turn.
Yeah, I believe that the abortion issue is a dark heart and is a big business financial decision by the abortionists. Or the fact, we had a young lady, a friend of our daughter's, we tried to talk out of getting an abortion, but she wanted to go through. She showed up for her abortion, and they turned her down because she did not have enough money and would not touch her or do anything with her without the money, and which gave us an opportunity to try to convince her not to do it. But I just truly think it's a dark heart and money-driven, and they don't care.
That's right.
At all.
Well, Mark, your point is very well made, and of course this affects even groups like Planned Parenthood, because people think of Planned Parenthood as an abortion rights advocacy group, but they often miss the point that it is also an abortion provider. They make money, and there is big money to be made in abortions. Otherwise, the people who are in it would not be in it. There are people getting wealthy off of this, and there is a big financial incentive behind it as well. And that's true even for what are now called tourist abortions. You know, one of the saddest things about our national conscience is that the United States has such open laws on abortion, such unrestricted access to abortion, that people are now putting together abortion tourism. So that people from Europe, from Asia, from other parts of the world who want an abortion but couldn't possibly get an abortion in their home culture are coming here to the United States in order to get it. Folks, tomorrow's show is really important, and I just want to tell you about it, so you may want to call a loved one, someone you care about, put it on your calendar, and make sure that you don't miss it under any circumstances tomorrow. Some of you will hear that dreaded word of diagnosis, cancer, and others will hear it about a loved one. Two people I know very well and love and respect have had that diagnosis in recent months, Dr. Don Whitney, author of the book, The Disciplines of the Christian Life, and Dr. John Piper, well-known Christian leader and author. We look at an article by Dr. Piper, whose cancer surgery was just a matter of days ago. His article's entitled, Don't Waste Your Cancer. What an interesting concept. My guest in the studio is Don Whitney, and he talks about his own experience. It's a God-honoring program that I think will help a lot of people who need help. Thanks to Matt, Jeremy, and Amber for help here in Nashville. I'll meet you tomorrow. This is Albert Muller.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.